So welcome back to UW Medicine Town Hall. I'm Trish Critic, Vice Dean for Faculty Affairs. It's been a while. It's good to see folks again. I'm happy to see with us Santiago Neme, Medical Director of UWMC Northwest. I'm happy to welcome back in a new role, Kristen Gordonier, who is our new Associate Chief Nursing Officer for UWMC Northwest. Kristen, it's great to have you back. John Lynch, Head of Infection Prevention and Employee Health at Harborview Medical Center. Cindy Sayer, CNO for UWMC. Tim Dellett, Interim Dean and CEO of UW Medicine. Ann Browning, on location at a school library, it appears, our Associate Dean for Well-Being. And Carrie Nazenbeni, the CNO for Harborview Medical Center. And unfortunately, we don't have Tom Steger here and Rick Goss here today, but they say they wish they were here with us. So, it's been a while. We're back together and going to kind of fall back into our usual routine and say, Anne, love to have a message of well-being.
Absolutely. And yes, I am in a public library down in California. I've been down here for a kind of healthcare professional well-being academic consortium meeting. And it was wonderful. But before heading back home, I wanted to take this call. So managed to find a library, which is very handy. What I wanted to share today was actually just my ridiculous excitement and slight overwhelmed nature relative to the well-being grants that we sent out and promoted across UW Medicine. We had those closed towards the end of April, and overall we had 311 proposals come in, which was just awesome. We had 206 from staff, 72 from faculty, 28 from trainees, 3 from postdocs. It represented all of our entities. We had folks from WAMI writing in with proposals. And honestly, it was just like really moving to see, you know, what ideas and creativity people had around kind of some small things, some bigger things that they could do to really move the dial and improve their work environments and really make UW Medicine a place people want to be and want to work, and how they can connect better to each other. So overall, we had over $1 million in requests from grants that topped out at $5,000. And that is just really, really neat. So we're doing everything we can to figure out how to stretch the funding we have from really generous donors as far as we can to really try and, you know, follow through on the wonderful ideas people gave to us. So huge thank you to the grant committee, grant review committee, who was helping kind of score and think through and process all of these grants with us. And also a really big thank you to our advancement team for, you know, doing tremendous work to try and figure out how we can, you know, think about well-being, fund well-being, and really move the dial forward with really generous community members who are wanting to see us, you know, be able to take care of ourselves and each other. So I am in a very happy place relative to these grants, even though it's a lot of reading, a lot of work. I just really want to say thank you to everybody who took the time to submit a proposal to us. It's been really neat to see.
And thank you for that. And I'll just echo your thanks to the advancement team and the donors who supported this. It's been huge. And to all the people who are reading those 300 plus grants, and a special thank you to you, because this has been something you've been motivated to do for quite a while. And I'm really happy to see it come to fruition. Yeah. So thank you for that. And thank you for investing in the well-being of our really large community.
Yes.
All right. We're going to jump into questions because there were quite a few, and they kind of fell into two themes. One was around COVID, and then the other was around Mission Forward. I'm going to actually start with COVID because this is how we started Town Hall. So John, I'm going to start with you. And, you know, I think we always start with numbers. And I wonder if maybe you could give a sense of kind of the trends of numbers since the last time we came together, which was, you know, a few months ago. So patients who are testing positive for SARS-CoV-2 maybe in our spaces.
Out of town hall practice, forget to hit the mute button. No, I'm never on Zoom anymore. You know, you'd think I would have had to figure it out. Feel free to guide me as I go through this, Trish, and let me know what's really helpful. So across UW Medicine, we have about 24 inpatients. We only one of them is in the ICU. Everyone else is in acute care. And I know at least at Harborview, at least one of those patients is in behavioral health, so not even requiring acute care. And I would say that over the last maybe 3 to 4 weeks, it feels like we've sort of stepped down after about 2 to 3 months of pretty stable numbers in the 30s over our entire system. So Valley, Northwest, Montlake, and Harborview. And so in the last 3 weeks, a consistent step down around that low 20s number, and very few people in the ICU.
I think that that's super helpful. I think the other thing that came out in the questions is, like, kind of you alluded to it with, like, somebody in behavioral health, like, how many of these patients do we think are sick because they're infected with SARS-CoV-2 or positive and in the hospital? And I wonder if you could reflect on that a little bit.
Yeah, you know, as I've mentioned before, it isn't something we actually track that much, because we do a lot of in-depth evaluation to determine whether this is what we call a true positive. You know, is this the first person's first diagnosis, regardless of their symptoms? You know, or is it something that's left over from a prior known infection or a prior known positive test? Mm-hmm. And why I say that is because what we first want to do is obviously take care of the patient if they have symptoms or have active infection and are at risk for progression. Second, we really want to protect everyone around those patients. So to some extent, it doesn't matter to us whether they're here for or with. And so it's not something we really invest resources into tracking carefully. But I can tell you that King County does. And so if you actually go to the King County COVID dashboard, which has been updated recently, and I can certainly tell you how that's been updated here if that's helpful. But they actually, if you look at their dashboard, they look at hospitalizations for COVID. And I think they have a team that's trying to discern this in different ways. And what we can see there is that the hospitalization rate for COVID has been pretty stable. I think it mimics what we're seeing with our inpatient numbers. It has slowly, very slowly trended down. And it also seems to be very close in terms of its slope, its trend downward, to sort of the death rate, which is a pretty definitive diagnostic. And I think there's been increasingly better tools for determining who's dying with COVID or for because of COVID complications versus people who die from, you know, motor vehicle accident and the complications that who happen to have a COVID diagnosis. So I think what we're seeing is a slow trend downward, not as fast as we would hope. The numbers in our hospitals across King County, including UW Medicine hospitals, remain, you know, not zero. And again, in the hospitals themselves, we're keeping everyone on the right level of precautions.
So I think a lot of things in there that kind of responded to a bunch of questions that people had. So number one, our numbers are slowly coming down. Number two, King County is keeping track of, to the best of their ability, who is sick because of COVID and who happens to test positive. And those numbers seem to also be coming down in the hospitalizations, though haven't gone to zero. Same with deaths. And, you know, one of the things that came up in a bunch of questions was, like, now that there's no more quote unquote John Lynch emails, where can I go to have a sense of these things? And it seems like maybe the King County site is the best place to go. Is that right?
I think it's a great website. So the King County team has fantastic data management. They've been doing this work since the very beginning, and I think have continued to commit resources to maintaining it. And so with the end of the public health emergency recently, some of the required reporting from hospitals and from local health jurisdictions has stopped. And so the what you see on the dashboard is actually more focused on healthcare numbers than ever before. And that's really what you can see there. So, and I think it's definitely valuable if you want to track these data. And I think there may be some questions around who would want to track these data specifically later. But I think looking at our whole county and how hospitalizations are occurring across our county is probably a much more robust way and more accurate way to understand what's happening with the epidemiology of COVID. And the Public Health Seattle King County dashboard is a great place to continue doing that tracking. And so you just Google Public Health Seattle King County, PHSKC, COVID dashboard, and it'll come up for you right there. It'll describe the changes they made over the last several months so that you understand what you're looking at.
I think that's super helpful. For those of you who are alive, Santiago put it in the chat, but I think John just told you how to find it if you're listening on a recorded version. And I appreciate that because I think we went from giving a lot of information and a lot of data to people to giving a lot less. And I think some people were like, thank you, stop giving us all those data. And some people were like, oh my gosh, where did those data go? So I appreciate the reference to that other resource. Okay. I have a few more. I'm going to come back to you later, but I have to do a few more on COVID to start with. And the single most common thing that people asked about was masking. And what mm-hmm. I would say is there's two categories of people and questions. And I'm going to go with the one that's most common and first, and that is, what are our plans for requiring masking going forward in light of changes in terms of the public health emergency and changes in the state kind of mandates from Jay Inslee et al.?
Yeah, sure. So sort of answering your questions a little bit backwards here. Right now, there is no requirement at the county, state, or federal level for us to wear masks in healthcare facilities. The data that drove those requirements have ceased to be available. So if folks recall, we had two big metrics that we're looking at, community level and community transmission level. And the community transmission level is what determined what actions we took from the infection prevention and employee health perspective. That data is gone. And so those metrics aren't available. And so right now, the CDC's guidance is for health systems and healthcare facilities to sort of determine their own risk matrix. Mm-hmm. And so what we determined when the requirement for masking ended at the state level was we actually worked across Western Washington with our local health jurisdictions, so Pierce, King, and Snohomish counties, as well as the Northwest Healthcare Response Network, to actually get together, all of our health systems to get together and talk about this and wrestle with it, because it's not an easy, answer. And what we determined as a sort of a region was that we're going to commit to continue masking in patient care spaces, and I think for most of us in public spaces in our healthcare facilities through the end of June. Why did we pick that date? Well, part of it is there's a lot of unknowns. We have this new Kraken variant, circulating around. It's more transmissible than all the others. And when we made that determination, we were still learning about its pathogenicity, how sick it makes people. We weren't sure whether the numbers are going to go up or are they going to go down. We weren't sure about the metrics, right? Whether CDC was going to develop new information. We weren't sure there's going to be new CDC guidance, and this is still out there. We don't know whether the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, OSHA, was going to give out the other guidance. So as we sort of wanted to see how things were going to trend, we thought we'd, just block out a clear window so everyone was clear that we are maintaining masking in both patient care and public spaces through the end of June as we learn more about this pandemic pathogen. And I'm using that word deliberately because we still can't predict what's going to happen. It is very likely we're going to see surges of these Omicron variants this summer, probably in the fall. We've been seeing 3 to 4 per year, and that may be the pattern, but we don't know. And until we get better information and know where we are, so those rates of hospitalizations and deaths even come lower, or we get a better sense of what's going to happen in the near future, we're going to sort of hold tight and observe through the end of June and then reassess all the information and guidance we have as a whole health system. And I think working with our other health system colleagues around what's the best possible thing to keep people safe who come to seek our care and keep our healthcare workers safe in all of those spaces.
Okay. I think that's incredibly helpful. And I think you've just mandated a town hall sometime in the summer, but for now it's masking in public spaces and healthcare spaces through the end of June in collaboration with people in our region in the space of there being ongoing uncertainty and erring on the side of being cautious. And I think a lot of people are anxious to take off their masks. I will say there's also many people who are anxious to keep on their masks. So I want to say there were more questions asking when we would stop masking than the other, but there were also people who said, what if you still want to mask and everyone around you has stopped masking? What's your advice to those folks, or how do you do that?
Yeah, so one, I think we have to support and empower each other to make the best possible decisions for ourselves and our families and our loved ones. So that may be, wearing the highest quality surgical mask. It may be wearing an N95. It may be wearing them in certain settings and others. And what I would recommend is that we all support each other around the decisions we're making for our own health and our own safety. And maybe even going on the limb, given the way things are out in the world right now, and actually stepping up and saying, hey, it's great seeing you wearing a mask. Like, I totally support you. And maybe just giving them a thumbs up so that they understand that you support them. I don't know how everyone here feels, but, we've in the last month or so, I've had family members and friends go into places with a mask on, and people point and laugh or say something, and that is not helpful for anyone. Wearing a mask is about personal decision-making at this point, for better or worse, outside of our hospitals, right? And we should be supporting each other because that may be the best thing for that person and their loved ones and their family. And so that'd be we should feel empowered to do it. And we should be empowering each other to make those good decisions.
I really appreciate that message. And I'm going to come back to the risk for people who are immunocompromised or folks in their family who are immunocompromised, because that came up in a bunch of questions earlier. But I think the spirit of the answer is going to be the same, which is let's empower each other to do what feels right for yourselves and your family. I'm going to ask you one more before I pivot to Tim, and then we'll come back with more COVID questions, because there are a bunch. When should we expect the next booster? I think there were a bunch of questions asking what's on the horizon and when are we going to see it?
You know, this, I love it when you ask me these questions, because I've practiced the answer. I don't know, right? I don't know. I think there's considerable, lack of clarity about this question. The WHO just came out with a recommendation for manufacturers to shift to a most recent variant booster in terms of manufacturing. So something more akin to the most local Omicrons. There are actually some data out there. They're actually presented at our ID retreat yesterday, that even people are immunocompromised. We're still not sure whether the ancestral strain, the original vaccines are still, in terms of severe illness, are that different than the boosters. So I think we got to get some more data and learn more. Would I be surprised if there's a recommendation for a bivalent booster for healthy adults and kids and youth in the fall? I wouldn't be surprised at all. But I can't tell you whether that's going to happen or not. The interesting thing about this is that, unlike influenza, where we always try to get all this sort of boosters into people before we see the flu season, is we're in COVID season all the time right now. And so we are all, if we're not wearing really high level respiratory protection, are being exposed to COVID in any crowded indoor, especially poorly ventilated setting. So that's very different than a lot of the other diseases that we are dealing with in terms of the vaccine preventable ones.
I appreciate that. And I think, again, kind of stay tuned. And seems like there's at least a reasonable chance that there will be a booster for many of us come the fall, but we don't know yet. And so I think people will continue to pay attention to that. Thank you. There are more questions about COVID. I will come back to them. I'm going to pivot to Tim. And Tim, there were some questions about Mission Forward and finance, as well as some questions that are related to COVID that I'm going to ask you as well. But I would say the most common question that came in about this was about the layoffs for outpatient physical therapy and kind of our decision-making around that. So I thought I would ask you about that to start with.
Great. No, thank you, Trish. And thank you, everyone, for joining us here again. These are very difficult decisions. We recognize the impact on the individual employee and something that we give a lot of thought to. At the same time, when you look at where we are, and just as an example, UW Medical Center through April has lost $62 million. When you look at next fiscal year, they're projected their budget to be a negative $120 million. And so we have to change the way we operate. And part of that is looking at areas where we can be more efficient in our care delivery. Some of that, as we saw, was an announcement around consolidating services. So rather than having services present at multiple locations, do we have them present at fewer locations to be more efficient in how we deliver those services? And that's really what happened there. And that did lead to the layoff of 44 full-time employees. Now, I would also say that we are working with those individuals so that in some situations, there are other openings within our system that we can help those individuals transition into. And so we are really working with each of them to try to think about, are there opportunities within our system as those consolidations occur?
I think, thank you for that. And I think it's hard. And I think it led to the next question that came up several times, which is, with that happening, the question about, are there further layoffs on the horizon, and kind of where do things stand as we kind of continue in the process of Mission Forward?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. And I want to be clear, there are no plans for across the board layoffs, or if you think back to the beginning of the pandemic when we did across the board furloughs. We learned a lot from that experience. And I think if we had to do that again in hindsight, we would do it differently. As we continue our work, we are continuing to look to see where are there redundancies, where are there opportunities from an efficiency standpoint? And so I would anticipate that there could be targeted layoffs in certain areas as we look through and think about how do we best provide those services in a more efficient manner, but no plans for widespread across the board layoffs. Unfortunately, if you look in the media, this all healthcare systems are going through this exact same process. It's an unfortunate part of healthcare and where we are given the challenges that we face. So we want to be thoughtful as we do this. But there could be additional targeted, not widespread layoffs in the future.
I think, thank you for that. And I think the reassurance that there's not going to be kind of across the board layoffs is reassuring. I think the reality is that there are still people who may be in that situation. And that's a hard thing to hear, particularly, you know, at a point when everyone's tired and feels like they've been working so hard. I appreciate your honesty about it though, because I think it's even harder when we're not, you know, honest and open about it. So thank you. Some people asked, you know, they had heard about the money that UW Medicine was going to get from the state. And when they were wondering if that could help mitigate some of the need to lay off people or make other cuts in roles and things like that.
Yeah, I think that's a great question too. And I have to give our government relations team, both here within UW Medicine, as well as our partners within the university, a lot of credit in terms of really helping the legislature understand that really critical and unique role that we play as a safety net organization and serving the most vulnerable within our state and quite frankly, within our region. And so with that information, we were very fortunate to receive $50 million for FY23, so this current fiscal year, as well as $100 million for FY24. And again, we will continue to work with the legislature in the future. That money definitely helps, but even with that, as I mentioned, UWMC is still looking at $120 million loss, and Harborview is looking at a $63 million loss for next year. Part of that is the incremental increases in labor costs. If you look at you know, expectations of over a 20% increase in our collective bargaining agreements over a two-year span, that equates to over $300 million between Harborview and UWMC from fiscal year 22 to fiscal year 24. That is a huge increase. Now, again, I have to say that we want our employees to be paid fairly. And so there is a big part of me that says, you know, that is very good for our employees, but it's happening in such a short, compressed period of time that it's outpacing our ability to increase revenue to match it. And so, yes, the state funding is absolutely essential, but so is our work around our directed payment programs, meaning how do we make up that difference for what we get paid through Medicaid to average commercial? How do we move forward with our mission forward work and really, really change the way we operate? So I think of the state funding as a bridge to allow a lot of our mission forward work to progress and get traction over this next fiscal year. And in fact, if you look at Mission Forward, we're estimating roughly $90 to $100 million of benefit in the budgets through that work, and that will continue to increase. So all of these pieces have to come together to help us achieve that financial stability. And again, ultimately, what's most important to me is that we are able to continue to serve our community and continue to meet our mission of serving the most vulnerable. But in order to do that, we are going to have to make tough decisions and we are going to have to change the way we operate so that overall we can continue to serve that mission. But it does mean that in some areas, we are going to have to make difficult decisions, potentially consolidate services as we've seen, and make changes into our overall operations to be more efficient in how we deliver that care.
Okay, so I think big things I heard are helps a lot to have that money, and we have a greater need than is going to be met by having that money from the state. We're doing other things like increasing payment for the care that we serve to the people who are most vulnerable by trying to match what we would get from insurance with the government's help. And also we're going to need to do things to kind of change how we do business in terms of being more efficient in what we do, with the eye on the part of kind of serving the patient and their family. I think it's a hard time. So there's a lot of evolution here. And I think this probably is another reason to have another town hall over the summer as this kind of continues and we keep understanding what the different impacts are on the system, but also on individuals, because I think that's what comes through in some of the questions. So I appreciate your kind of walking through that together. One more question about Mission Forward that came up is, it has felt like much of the focus has been on inpatient changes for Mission Forward. Obviously this outpatient physical therapy would be an exception, but is there a focus on changes in our primary care spaces as well with Mission Forward?
Yeah, Mission Forward will touch all aspects of UW-Madison. So not just hospitals, but our School of Medicine. It will impact our ambulatory areas, all of those areas. Now, as we transition from the initial assessment that was done by our partners at Huron, we're in that kind of decide and design as well as implementation phase. And we just kicked off the care delivery initiative that is focused more on the inpatient side. It's looking at capacity management, perioperative, how we manage our OR capacity. It's looking at length of stay, care management, but ambulatory and how we deliver that care, including primary care, all areas will be involved. This is an all play. It is going to take all parts of UW-Madison to really turn this around and continue to serve our community.
Okay, I appreciate that. So yes, it's all spaces and all different aspects of the umbrella of UW-Madison. Okay, I'm going to pivot back to COVID and ask you two last questions before I go to our nursing and medical staff leadership. One question that came up a few times is about our COVID vaccine requirements. And I don't know if you want to answer this or John, but I think the question is, are we going to evolve our COVID vaccine requirements? And really the corollary that came up is, what does that mean for employees who were terminated because they opted not to get vaccinated?
Yeah, I can start and John can correct me. The university just made an announcement that in general for employees outside of healthcare, that they are no longer requiring vaccination as a condition of employment. That will take place after the end of this current quarter. So in mid-June to allow a little bit of time for that transition. So that's where the overall university is moving. Within healthcare, I think we anticipate moving in a similar direction with a few caveats. One of the confounders, though, is that CMS continues to require COVID-19 vaccination of healthcare workers as a condition of participation. So since we get paid for Medicare, as an example, we have to continue requiring that within the healthcare environment. We anticipate at some point CMS will change that language. Once that occurs, what I anticipate we will likely do is transition so that our COVID-19 vaccination process is analogous to what we do for influenza and what we did for the boosters, meaning that we would require everyone to participate. You would either need to get vaccinated, which we strongly encourage. If not, then you would go through a declination process similar to what we do for influenza and what we've done with the boosters. Interestingly, again, the FDA no longer has authorized that original series of COVID-19 and has transitioned more to the bivalent, what we use for the booster. So we're just in that process where we have to wait until CMS changes their requirements for us to adopt that in healthcare. But it's something that we are monitoring and that we anticipate will happen here at some point here in the near future. John, I don't know if you have any additional comments.
You nailed it.
Oh, now, okay.
So now in terms of previous employees who were terminated, yeah, they would be eligible to apply for open positions just as anyone would be. There is not a automatic coming back. They would have to go through that same application process, but they would be eligible to do so once CMS changes their requirements, or outside of healthcare within the university construct, they would be eligible if there were open positions to apply for those.
Okay, so university is changing its stance as of the end of the quarter with a little bit of wiggle room there. We're not changing it based on CMS not having changed, but anticipate that we will have a policy that's similar to what we have for influenza, where you have to participate, but you can formally decline in the way that we have structured that. And people can reapply for jobs, but they're not going to automatically come back into the job that they had been in before. I appreciate that. I think that a lot of people are curious about that. And I think we'll see how that evolves over the next few months as well. Thank you. I'm going to pivot to Carrie and Cindy and Kristen. And I would say the most common question that we got that I think I'm going to direct to the three of you, and again, you can bring in John if you want to, is about the evolution of our visitor policy. So Cindy, I'll ask you, what are the plans for our visitor policy evolving beyond two visitors in a room now that we're letting more people into the hospitals and into the waiting rooms?
Yeah, thank you for that question. What we have just recently decided to do is take the visitor policies back to the individual entities. So we had one UW Medicine policy. It was pretty cumbersome to work through if anybody wanted to make a change. So we are, at the end of this month, going to be transitioning back to individual policies for UWMC and Harborview. So I can say for UWMC, we're going to continue two visitors at the bedside at a time. There's no limit for the day, right? So people could switch out if they wanted to. The reason for this is, really we need to have access to the patient for the care team. And if we don't set some kind of limit to how many people can be in that room, it just sometimes there's just so many visitors that we can't provide care. As always, as we've done all throughout COVID, there are exceptions, right? If someone's at end of life and there are three visitors or four that need to come in, then we make those exceptions. But the two visitors at a time is going to remain the standard for UW Medical Center.
Okay, so two visitors at a time, but can be lots of different twos throughout the day and more if it's end of life or other specific circumstances. Carrie, how is that different from what's going to be the policy at Harborview?
Yeah, thanks, Trish. That's a great question. That's also the exact policy at Harborview is two at a time. And I don't foresee that changing in the immediate future, I think for all the same reasons that Cindy mentioned, but also because the vast majority of our rooms are double rooms. And so it gets crowded in those rooms really, really quickly. When you think about two patients, sometimes three patients, and then each of them having two visitors. And so I think just from a space component, we're really just not set up to manage more than that at this moment. And also just to say it out loud, it's not perfect, right? I mean, two people might be at the bedside and then two more people might show up. And so we already are navigating sort of some of those challenging spaces. And so I don't think that's going to change unless something changes dramatically with COVID, and then we might change again, obviously. But I think for the foreseeable future, provided nothing changes with COVID, we're going to stay the course of where we are. And I think, you know, as always, we'll continue to revisit this. I think it's a question that many of our staff have and our patients and our families, and want to keep sort of coming back to it and rethinking this and making sure we're doing it the best that we can.
Okay, so right now, same policy at both places, even though we now can have different policies at different places. And Kristen, I'm going to assume it's the same at Northwest because it's all one hospital. I will ask, and anyone can chime in, I think one of the things that people expressed in their questions was that sometimes it feels like it's inequitable because some families or others will advocate more for more people at the bedside. And I'm just curious how we mitigate that to the best of our ability. And I don't know, Cindy, if you want to comment on that.
Yeah, I know that that's come up at Montlake, so I feel like we can speak to it. We have one visitor policy. Now, are people challenging boundaries or challenging the policy? For sure, as kind of Carrie alluded to. But it's really important to us to have equitable activation or implementation of the policy. We have it for a reason, so it really shouldn't matter if there's some kind of privileged state that one patient has or something like that. So we work to say no to that as much as we know about it. I do encourage staff to escalate. So if they're seeing that happen, to make sure that their manager is aware of the situation. Sometimes those power differentials are hard to overcome depending on who's doing the advocacy for more visiting. So I just encourage people to escalate if they need to, but really we want one policy for all of our patients.
Okay. So supporting the uniform implementation of the policy and bump it up if it feels like there's tension and pressure to not follow that. I appreciate that. And I think it is an ongoing tension because it came through in a bunch of questions. Kristen, I'll ask you the question. People were asking, how has it gone with reintroducing families into waiting rooms and not having those spaces that were protected before for staff, now for families again? How has that gone at Northwest or wherever you want to reflect on, but probably Northwest?
Yeah, thanks for that question. You know, it's a transition, and you think we have been using those family waiting spaces as break spaces for 3 years. So we have quite a few nurses that have never known, or nurses and team members who have never known anything different. That's where they've always taken their breaks. So that's a big change for them. So we're working hard. I'm really pleased with the timing of the break space work that was done. So many of our break spaces were refreshed, and we're continuing to make sure that people feel like there is adequate space for breaks and that those are pleasant areas to take their break in. But it's a hard, it was a hard transition.
Yeah, I appreciate your honesty about how it was challenging. And I think I never had that perspective that this might be all that somebody knows. Only during COVID. So thank you for that lens. And that's certainly true for trainees as well, and the kind of changes that have occurred, that they've only been here for this time. So that makes sense. So thank you. Last question for our CNOs, and Carrie, I'll start with you. Kind of speaks to what Tim was talking about before, about questions about how we're assuring competitive salaries for all our staff in the midst of the current financial challenges. And, you know, Tim just talked about the pressure of that. And so how are we kind of navigating that as we move forward?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think one thing to just remind everyone is we renegotiated all of our contracts less than 9 months ago. And all of those contracts had the most generous I've ever seen salary increases that I've seen in the 24 years that I've been at UW Madison. So I think that's one way, is working with our labor partners, right? And making sure that we're staying competitive. And we look at wages across the city and ensure that we're remaining competitive with, you know, the Swedish, the other hospitals in the system. There are job classes that are not covered by our labor contracts, and those our compensation team is just doing a yeoman's job of really working through those job classes. Some of them are also go through the state and through that process. So this is, I think, a priority for all of us. It's one way that we show recognition for our teams and also retain them, right? And I think that retention is a critical piece and cost savings as well. And so I think a ton of work has been done in the space, and I think it's something like our visitor policy that we're going to have to keep revisiting until our economy and inflation, et cetera, and that market stabilizes.
Okay, so ongoing negotiations, ongoing examination of this, continuing to work with our labor partners and kind of looking at it in different dimensions. Cindy, is there anything you wanted to add to that?
Yeah, really, really nothing to add to what both Carrie and Tim have said.
Yeah. I think obviously the financial pressures of the world outside of the hospital remain real for lots of people as well. So thank you. Santiago, I'm going to turn to you as our sole medical director representative. And there were a handful of questions about the fact that the census is still so high, and are we having any progress in finding places for people to go for post-acute care or strategies for difficult to discharge patients? Where do we stand with those efforts?
Yeah, so for a long time now, our CEOs, Summer and Cindy Hecker, have been working on the post-acute care and trying to kind of remove a lot of the obstacles and barriers. These past 2 weeks have been significantly worse than our normal, where we saw very few discharges. We're talking about a third of the discharges that we would normally have due to very extended approval processes now at a lot of the skilled nursing facilities, but also just them being full. And that really hindered us this week, particularly where at UWMC Montlake, the ER only has a capacity of 27 beds, and 20 beds were occupied for about 48 hours, which renders the ER completely dysfunctional or not operational. So the challenges are there. What I can say is that in partnership with Cindy Sayer, Tom Steger, Dr. Rick Goss, and Elise Schleyer, we're actually revamping our capacity management structure and work. And we're going to invite a lot of the stakeholders, from physicians, from nurses, from social workers, to really come to the table and see what we can do together as one hospital, UWMC, one hospital, Harborview, but also as a system. Harborview today, for instance, had a capacity of 120%. UWMC started at 101%. So these are very high numbers. We want to come up with new ideas, because this landscape that we thought would get better faster, it's clearly not getting better as fast as we would like. And we still want to treat and have access for all the patients who need to be at UW Medicine to get better. So a lot of work in this regard, and we're launching kind of a new focused intervention on that together with all of the stakeholders. So I look forward to this work, and it's not easy, it's not solved, but there is a lot of focus on that. Cindy, Carrie, Kristen, if you want to add, because we all live this every day.
I think I just want to add my thanks to the teams. It has been an incredibly challenging week with capacity, so I don't want to miss the chance to thank everyone, because it does hit every single person in the building in terms of the workload. And just look forward to the partnership, Santiago, to try to identify some creative solutions for what's happening.
And I want to just add a couple of comments around the difficult to discharge patients, or those patients who are medically ready for that next level of care, but we haven't been able to find the right space, mm-hmm. because this is also a partnership that we had through this last legislative session. So Harborview has a program referred to as the Bed Readiness Program, where they, in essence, pay $8 million a year for about 80 beds at Queen Anne to provide additional payments to cover the cost for these complex patients, but also wraparound services. So nurses, social workers go and train the staff at those facilities so that they can care for these more complex patients. We worked with the legislature to get approval for a pilot program that the state will fund that will include Harborview as well as four other sites around the state to really scale that model that we developed at Harborview. And ultimately, our goal is to continue to scale that, bring in federal dollars to support that so that we are not having to support that ourselves alone, but rather this is a state initiative. There will also be an associated task force, which we at UW Medicine will be leading in this space. So again, it's just another example of, I think, a very good outcome and partnership through the legislative session, really building off of the innovation of our teams here, particularly the bed readiness program at Harborview.
So a lot there. New efforts to collaborate in a systems in this way to try to work together for using our beds that we have as best we can. And I appreciate that sentiment from Santiago and others. A thanks to people for navigating a really challenging time. And then Tim, I think really highlighting the investment at the state level to try to test out these models that have already been implemented at Harborview, where we're partnering with skilled nursing facilities and actually paying for the beds to take care of patients after they leave the hospital, and kind of building a bigger system of that to hopefully transition from us paying for it to the government paying for it. So lots actually going on, and I think also continues to feel like a stressor to lots of people and a concern for lots of people. So I appreciate all of that in that space. Thank you all.
Trish, if I may add, we're also working with the medical directors in terms of how we communicate these situations where there's high census. What's the best way to communicate this to the medical and nursing staff, so then it's not shocking or unpleasant or just something they forget about the next minute or just delete immediately? So we're evaluating what would be the best way to communicate some of these situations for awareness, but without raising an inappropriate level of alarm, for instance. So more to come on communications. I think that we could do this better. And I think, but again, it's going to be part of this partnership.
Okay. So always thinking of ways that we can more transparently and effectively communicate in many different domains. So I appreciate that, Santiago, and look forward to that in the future. Tim, I'm going to pivot back to you and ask you a couple other questions that are kind of COVID related. One was about kind of where we stand with telemedicine and whether like we're in a model where the patient gets to choose if it's a telemedicine visit or we choose, like how does that play out at this point in time across our system?
I think in general, it's a combination of both the patient and the practitioner deciding how is it best to care for this individual. Do they have a condition or a medical need that can be cared for effectively through telehealth, or is it better to see that person in person? So there's not an absolute guidance, but rather individual decisions and preferences to some degree by patients. There are some patients who really want to use telemedicine to avoid having to come in to the clinic. And if it is a situation where that makes sense for their health, then great, we can do that. I would say there are some changes now, and we're still evaluating as we shift from the public health emergency ending on May 11th and the impact on telemedicine. Now, the good thing is some of those waivers and benefits that we saw through the pandemic have been extended, at least for a short period of time. Our goal is to get them ideally permanent, but that's going to take some changes by CMS. And so we're hoping and really advocating to try to prevent going backwards in what our capabilities are to serve our patients through telemedicine.
So it sounds like it kind of depends, and it's a little bit driven by what's going on with the patient and the patient's desires. There's some evolution in kind of, can we do it in the way that we did it during COVID because of the waivers, particularly for people in other places. I guess one of the questions that was kind of embedded in that is, if patients want to be seen in person, is that always an option, or are we at any time saying what we have to offer is telemedicine?
I'm not aware of our turning down patients who want to be seen in person. You know, again, I think we try to balance what the patient, how they want to receive their care, and what we think is in their best interest to really partner with them in their care.
Okay. Maybe last one. How will changes in charging facility fees impact billing for outpatient telemedicine if folks do that from home? Is that something that people can do?
Well, that's an example. With the transition from the public health emergency, you can't charge facility fees if you are performing those services at home. Now, the good thing is that they extended the ability to perform telemedicine from home without registering your address with CMS, because typically that would be a requirement. But that has been waived at least through the end of 23. And again, hopefully that will continue, because again, in some ways that just doesn't make a whole lot of sense. But the facility fees are gone.
Okay.
If you're doing it at home.
That's an example of what you were talking about. Yeah. So I appreciate your clarifying that for me and for everyone else. So thank you. Okay. I'm going to try to fit in a handful of COVID questions here as we come into the last part of town hall. So John, I'm going to come back to you. One question people asked is, what is our current guidance on quarantine and isolation? Are they the same as they have been all along or most recently, or is that evolving?
Do you mean in the hospital or just in general? I just want to make sure.
I think that, I don't know what,
I'm going to go in general. How about that?
Okay, because yeah, let's do that.
Our inpatient stuff's all the same, right? How we take care of patients with known or exposed COVID. On the outpatient side, what I'm going to really recommend doing, because no one's going to remember what I'm about to say, because it's, as always, not straightforward and not super simple. And I'll try to get the link and I'll put it in the chat or wherever Ann wants me to put it. There's a calculator that you can go in and say, I've been exposed, or I'm positive, my test is positive, and it will kind of walk you through the recommendations. Broadly, the isolation recommendations that we talked about in the last year are pretty much still in place. So there's no vaccinated, you know, boosted, anything like that. It's really around, do you have a positive test, or when did your symptoms start, right? Or both. And the 5-day rule is still in play. And with the recommendation that after 5 days, if you're feeling well or feeling better, no fever, you can go, if you need to, you can go back out into sort of public life, but you should be wearing a mask. The only way to get out of, you know, masking, if that's what you want to do, is to do the 2 tests, right? Separated by 48 hours. So everything's pretty much the same. And again, I'm not going to go into great detail I made a whole bunch of notes, but the more I made them, I realized the best thing to do is to go to the little calculator. I tested it out with some different scenarios and it's pretty straightforward. And so I really recommend going and just doing that. Don't even bother reading everything. Just do that.
Okay.
Because honestly, everything's pretty much the same as it was the last, you know, bunch of times we talked about this, the five and 10 days. If you have symptoms, first day of symptoms. If you have no symptoms, the first day of your test, that really dictates when you start counting the days.
Okay. I'm going to just highlight, use the calculator and it's 5 days, 5 days from testing positive if you're asymptomatic, or 5 days from when your symptoms start, and then wear a mask. And then you can do the nuances beyond that. Relevant to that, people asked a lot of questions about, are we going to continue to offer PCR testing? Because I think people are maybe skeptical about at-home testing.
Yeah, so this is a really fascinating area. So I put the link in there for the calculator. I may have spelled that wrong because I was doing it fast. It's on that webpage. It's like it's a hyperlink right near the top of the page. So your question was about...
My question was, yeah. Are we going to still offer PCR testing?
Oh, PCR. Yeah, so...
I was making you multitask. I apologize.
No, I was making myself multitask. I just knew I'd forget if I didn't do it. So think about COVID-19, right, as flu, as everything else. Anybody who needs to get tested can get tested, right? It's just that we don't have the big drive-through sites. You know, the big lab medicine sites are pretty much closed down or will close down. The demand just isn't there. I'm based in Harborview. Anybody who walked over to the Bourne garage knew there was very rarely people out in that testing facility just before, you know, the weeks coming up to when it was closed. So think about, yeah, primary care clinics can test for COVID. Urgent cares can test for COVID. Emergency departments can test people for COVID. Our lab medicine colleagues have maintained capacity for very high volumes should those be needed. So they can run, I think, if I remember, any of the lab medicine folks are on here, I'm pretty sure last time I talked to them, they could run up to like 3,000 tests a day, like no problem, like tomorrow. And right now they're doing, I think, 300 to 500. So they have the capacity, all the technology's there, all the reagents are there, the swabs are there. We have good supplies around all that. And you can get testing. The patients can get tested everywhere. And we are trying to figure out whether should we see a big surge, whether we would need to do something at our sites around supporting our healthcare worker colleagues. Right now, our rec is, you know, go through like you would have flu, right? Get tested wherever you are. There may be some limited capacity in our employee health clinics, but really we don't want to bring people with symptoms into those spaces. They're not really meant for that purpose.
So it sounds like across the system, we still have the ability to do PCR testing and we have the ability to ramp up a lot. And I will just make one public health recommendation that we also don't want people to come into the ED just to get tested for COVID. So there is the ability to do it in our EDs, but we're not recommending that as a place to do the PCR testing. And we're going to maintain that ability across UW Medicine. Yep. So,
and I put that in the Q&A. Someone asked that question. You should be going to the emergency room if you have an emergency. But if you need to get tested, primary care, if you need to, urgent care.
Then I'm going to try to squeeze in like a couple more quickly. Do you have a better sense of what the percentage of infections that are leading to long COVID are? And if we're seeing an evolution of how people are doing with post-COVID syndromes?
Yeah. So I did try to look this up a bit. And I know we have experts in our system. And again, they're welcome to put stuff in the chat or otherwise. But there was a study. It is called INSPIRE. It's a prospective cohort study. So they're following everyone with these symptoms. And they're basically broadly defining people as long COVID folks who have symptoms beyond 4 weeks. And they're looking at how long those symptoms last. Now, they're out at 18 months now, which I think was their endpoint. So there's many other studies that are ongoing that will tell us more. But when you look across the data that are available, and you look at all of the symptoms, which range from constitutional like fatigue and maybe feeling hot and febrile, to things like chest pain and sore muscles, it ranges from about 5.5% to 27%, depending upon which group. So the most common persisting symptoms, that 25%, are upper respiratory symptoms. So cough, stuffiness, hearing, things like that, followed by the constitutional ones, the brain fog, the fatigue, things like that. And then next is musculoskeletal, so sore muscles and joints. Now, there are others, gastrointestinal, cardiovascular, but they appear to be lower. And so we know at 18 months, so So 18 months out from an infection, this document in the study, 5.5 to 27% of people continue to experience symptoms. The other part I really want to point out here, and why this isn't evolving and why I can't give you super hardcore answers, is that pre-Omicron appeared to carry a much higher risk. Not being vaccinated appeared to be carry a higher risk versus Omicron. And that is unclear in my reading so far, whether that's related specifically to the effects of the virus in our immune system or to the severity of disease. There appears to be a pretty tight correlation between how sick you are. So if you get severe COVID, you end up in the hospital, or if you end up in the ICU, the risk of those symptoms lasting longer are higher. So being like vaccinated, you know, in preventing infection, severe disease and death, obviously that's a protector. But Omicron was also caused less severe disease. We saw a lot of cases because of so many numbers, but yeah. On a per person level, the risk seemed to be lower.
Okay. So I think take homes are, we're still learning for sure. And a significant portion of people still have symptoms at 18 months, but I'm going to say the majority of patients don't. And I think I'm going to take that glass half full perspective on that, which is great. And perhaps that we're going to see less of this with people who've been vaccinated and people who get later infections with Omicron. So thank you for looking into that and sharing. I'm going to ask you two last questions. The first one is your guidance for people who are immunocompromised at this point.
Yep. Yeah, so let me just run down the list. And I have to say, the CDC messaging is just getting increasingly robust. And so everything I'm saying is available there as well. But I'm going to run down a list. So staying up to date with your vaccinations. So there are updated vaccination recommendations for folks who are over age 65 and those that are immunocompromised, immunosuppressed. So please check the website. Make sure there's a calculator there too, where you can put in that stuff and it'll tell you whether you're up to date or not. Use a high quality mask or respirator. And again, we should be supporting each other because we don't know what everyone else's status is like. It's like, so the person parking in that parking spot that's designated, right? Not all disabilities are visible. And so we should be supporting people when they make those choices. You know, this is a tough one, avoiding poorly ventilated and crowded indoor settings. I'm not saying this is equitable or fair, but in terms of your risk assessment, if you are immunocompromised, immunosuppressed, or much older, trying to avoid those situations will decrease your risk of getting infected. Washing your hands frequently. We know that hand soap and water, gel all work great. So doing that regularly, which is going to, you know, pay off in lots of other things. Recognize symptoms. If you think you have symptoms of COVID, which could be pretty much any cold-like symptom or other serious, more serious symptoms, get tested. You can use the antigen test. They still work. Do them multiple times. Or get a PCR or do both. And the reason we really want to get you tested is that we can get you to treatment. And there's lots of programs locally to get people to treatment really fast. And there's a couple different treatments out there. So we have convalescent serum and we also have, or plasma, excuse me, and we have Paxlovid. So do that. You mentioned earlier where to look. I think looking at the epi data, looking at hospitalization numbers, because that gives you a sense of where things are going. Right now, numbers are headed in the right direction. I think that's going to be good for at least the next few months. But if you start to see those numbers start to rise, those are real numbers. Those are people ending up in the hospital. And then lastly, and again, I think this is a great recommendation, build a plan. Talk to your family, talk to your friends, talk to your healthcare provider about what you're going to do, what risk, you know, your risk assessment is here, what your decisions are going to be, and have those around you supporting those and be aware, hey, this person's got to get tested. They got to get to treatment. If I call my PCP, what's the plan for the weekend? If I start getting symptoms on a Friday night, what's my next plan, right? Am I going to this urgent care to get tested? And where do I get medications? Because we know the earlier you get access to testing and treatment, the better off you'll be. So that's my list. That's on the CDC website. Please go there and feel free to reach out to me if you have any questions.
I appreciate the comprehensive list. I'm not going to summarize it. I know Santiago wanted to say something quickly about remdesivir, though I'm going to say I'm showing my rustiness because we're tight on time. So do you have a couple quick words? That's okay.
Yeah, just for awareness, we have a program at UW Medicine for solid organ transplant patients who have had a transplant. And we have a remdesivir infusion protocol that's done at UWMC Northwest and is currently coordinated through SOTID. So lots of great work from Sharisha Dinaretti and Rupala Jain again, and Dr. Ajit LeMay also. Sincere thank you.
Okay. I love that everyone was always grateful for the collaboration. So thank you for sharing that. And I am as I said, rusty. So I'm going to wrap up and say, I know there were a bunch more questions and I'm sorry that I didn't get to all of them. I appreciate all the people who sent in questions and the many people who said, wait, why didn't you have a town hall again sooner? The world is still evolving. I do think we're at a very different place with COVID. However, there's still lots of questions about that and Mission Forward and other things in our community. So I heard you, we all heard you. We will have a town hall sometime in the summer. We'll get the news out to you when it's gonna happen. And I'll say to all of you, a great thank you for prompting us in that way. I wanna say one thing really quickly to squeeze it in. Tom Steger's not here and I don't think he's going to be at the next town hall because he is after many, many years of being an outstanding medical director from UWMC is stepping down from that role. And I just want to say from the bottom of my heart, thank you to Tom. He's one of the main reasons I'm at UW. And so thank you to Tom for all that he's done for UWMC, for UW, for Town Hall, and for all of us. We're going to be in great hands because Santiago is taking over as the medical director of UWMC. And I want to say welcome to Santiago and a deep, deep sense of gratitude. So Tom, you have to watch this, even if you have to watch it at 2x. Watch till the end so you can hear us all say thank you. Thank you. Thank you. And thank you to all of you for, as we still go through rocky chapters and new challenges, for continuing all that you do to take care of our learners who are about to graduate from medical school and are ending residency and fellowship. And most importantly, not most importantly, also importantly, our patients, their families, and I think most importantly, taking care of each other. Thank you for coming back together for Town Hall. We'll see you again in a few months. Bye.